Rob Wolf, Andy Dees, how are you, man?
Good. I've got a cat on my lap, and nothing weird with that. He just planted himself there, so.
Well, I have an enormous Dutch Brothers coffee, and, you know, hopefully that'll get me through the hour or whatever this goes. And I was also thinking, you know, we didn't really celebrate last time we recorded that we hit double digits, because this is actually 11, I believe, we're recording today.
Nice. Right on. Well, woohoo. And, I think we're up to about six total listeners, four of them in a rest home. So
we're I feel like we're gonna overuse that six listeners joke. We'll have to come up with something clever and unique for next week.
Yeah.
I like the guy on the blog that posted, you know, he enjoyed it every week when Rob said, oh, you know, I survived this week. Snipers didn't shoot me outside my house or something.
Yeah, it doesn't appear that I'll be renditioned anytime soon. Although if we do field a team at the CrossFit Games, I will probably be wearing some sort of a disguise.
Maybe a big beard and an afro.
Giant beard, yeah, and a yarmulke or something. So.
That would be awesome. All right, well, here we are. We got a group of questions. I don't think anything too controversial this week, Rob. Maybe one or two, but, you know, hopefully we'll keep your blood pressure low considering we're recording this in the AM and you got the cat to kind of calm you.
To calm me, yeah. I'll bring in a fish tank that's supposed to drop your blood pressure too, so.
All right, well, the first question is kind of a question about counter-arguments. So, Rob, I would love to see a podcast on common counter-arguments to paleo nutrition and good rebuttals. In other words, as a trainer, when we recommend this type of nutrition and the client says, well, my doctor says, what are some of these common worries and what should the appropriate response be?
You know, we literally could, and maybe we'll see if folks like what we do here, the little brief treatment that we do here. This literally could be a whole, probably hour-long podcast just on this, and so we'll kind of touch on it briefly. If folks are interested, then we can get in a little bit deeper on it. This, you know, this becomes a huge problem if you're a trainer and you're working with clients, and there's the whole kind of gray area of like recommending any type of food, you know, approach at all. Obviously, if you recommend the food pyramid, then I guess you're in the good graces. If you recommend lean meats, fruits and vegetables, nuts and seeds, then somehow that's not in the good graces. I'm not quite sure how all that stuff works. But folks do end up with these really common counterarguments. And I think one of the most common ones that pops up is that, and Professor Cordain touches on this, I don't know if people know, if you go to thepaleodiet.com, you click on the published research, then Professor Cordain has a common counterargument paper that he had published. And in that, he tackled a couple of the biggies. One of them is basically the statement that, you know, none of these Paleolithic ancestors lived that long. They had short, brutish lives, and so they didn't live long enough to be able to manifest cancer, diabetes, heart disease, and all that sort of stuff. And on the surface, that sounds great, but the problem that we have is that we have contemporarily studied hunter-gatherers, including the Achi Indians of Peru, the Inuit, the Kumsan of sub-Saharan Africa, and these people have been very extensively studied, anywhere from like 30 years to 100-plus years, and these people show that standard kind of hunter-gatherer health profile, which is that they really don't have any type of cancer, diabetes, or heart disease going on until they start adopting a westernized diet. And a subcategory of that is that, you know, even if, you know, let's say over the course of time we are more likely to develop some sort of degenerative disease, there are still people who develop cancer, diabetes, and heart disease at comparatively young ages. And so we're still not seeing any of that in these hunter-gatherer groups. So that's one of the big main points, I think. And, you know, when you start arguing with people or trying to persuade people on this stuff, really you've got maybe three different categories of people with all this. Maybe 50% of them may be open to this potentiality. 50% of them, 25% of the remaining 50%, you might be able to persuade them to do some reading on the topic, and they may come around to at least entertaining the potentiality. And then the remaining 25%, like, they're just, they're never going to be swayed by any amount of evidence. They've got their mind made up, and they just like to argue a lot. Nikki's cousin-in-law, I guess is what you would call him, is exactly that person. Like, he's a real bright guy, good dude, but doesn't matter what the topic is, he's always got the counterpoint to whatever you happen to be talking about. And he's always singing this song about, like, balance. And the balance deal, I know I'm getting a little off topic, but the balance thing is kind of funny. People will throw this notion out there about balance, but then they have absolutely no qualifier for what that means. I remember driving through, I got lost in Oakland one time, and I remember driving around there, and I just noticed that there was not a single, like, legitimate supermarket or even, like, corner market where you could buy, like, fruits, vegetables, and fresh meat for miles and miles and miles around. And so what does balance mean for an area of town in which the only things that you have to choose from are convenience stores and taco trucks? You know, I mean, it's just kind of a preposterous notion, but that's a whole other side deal. Another real common counterpoint about the whole paleo thing is that high protein intake, high dietary protein intake is going to give you renal disease, and it absolutely is not. Like, a simple Google search on this topic, high protein diet, renal disease, kidney disease, either one, and you've got a slew of scientific resources on that that show that unless there is some sort of pre-existing renal or kidney disease, high protein intake is not a factor in that. It may actually improve renal function. So that's another very easily put to bed question. There's always the protein debate that's floating around, which we did that via the performance menu. I think we had a link to that a couple of shows back, Andy.
Yes, we did, in the show notes, yep.
So the protein debate is a great resource for a ton of different, you know, kind of paleo counterpoints. Cordain did an amazing job on that. I think he actually ends up addressing more issues in the protein debate on this kind of counterpoint than he did in his counterpoint paper itself. So that's another good piece. From there, I guess you just kind of have to tackle them a thing at a time. You know, people will say, well, what about the Asian diet? That's always a great one. You can point out the differences between Okinawans and then standard, you know, kind of Japanese population. The Okinawans eat more protein in total. They get the bulk of their carbohydrates from kind of yam and sweet potato type items. They live longer. They tend to be 6 to 8 inches taller because the yams and sweet potatoes don't have the anti-nutrients that the rice contains. And so they end up getting taller when the, Japanese first generation, second generation Japanese Americans end up being taller than what their parents are because of the more nutrient-dense diet. So there's a bunch of this stuff that you can kind of put to rest, but it takes a little bit of time. And ultimately, luckily, I'm at a point of busyness where I just don't have to spend that much time convincing people. You know, folks are more or less kind of bought in on what we're up to, and so that convincing side of things is minimized. One final thing that I'll say on this, and again, like, if people find this an interesting topic, we could really get in and flesh out, say, like, 15 or 20 points and get in and really look at each one of them very detailed. But the final thing that I would just say is that there's still, if you Google Flat Earth Society, there are still people on the planet who believe that the planet is flat and that we never went to the moon, that the whole NASA thing is a farce. And so, you know, there are people that, depending on, you know, how big of a jerk you want to be, you can say they're either naive or they're idiots. And, you know, to some degree, that's true with the whole food thing. There are people that are just absolutely going to be convinced of whatever it is that they're convinced of, and that's it. For myself, even though it's horrible, possibly horrible to admit, I've run the whole spectrum. I've done standard American diet. I've done vegan. I've done kind of lacto-ovo vegetarian. I've done uber low-carb kind of paleo-esque deal. I've done higher carb, more along the lines of the paleo diet recommendation that Cordain has done. I kind of feel like I've done every single thing that I can, and granted, that's only a N equals one. It's only a sample size of one. But I've at least got my own experience. I have blood work at each one of those nutritional regimens and whatnot. And I have some performance values. And I know how I looked, felt, and performed and all that. So I've got a pretty good benchmark on that. if somebody is making some sort of an argument that any, nutritional protocol or exercise protocol does or doesn't work, and they haven't played with it, I think they're just full of shit. And I think at some point that's where the rubber really hits the road. And I think that that's where if you are talking to someone and trying to educate them on this whole paleo approach, there's obviously a big spectrum of what that whole paleo thing means. For real high-performing athletes, we probably have more carbohydrate in their diet. For, generalist people, we probably have less. But that said, the commonalities are more than the separations. And we can always hang our hat on how the person looks, feels, and performs, and we can track biomarkers of health and disease. And there's no flat Earth society element to that. You know, it's very quantifiable, very provable, but people just need to get in and try it. And I guess that would be the thing that I would leave folks with if they're having some sort of conversation with people on this topic is, throw out there, hey, why don't you try this? Why don't you gauge how you look, feel, and perform? Why don't you do some blood work before and afterwards, and then let's see how it actually works for you. And then it's not an argument. It's not some sort of a arm wrestling match or something like that. It's really just their own personal experience on it.
Yeah, and I think, only two thoughts on this. One, Flat Earth Society, Rob, I noticed that in the gym this morning at one of the terminals, that webpage was up. So clearly you were spun up talking to somebody over the weekend.
One of our new clients in the on-ramp class, his father is a local physician, and he said that his dad is interested in all this stuff, but he's very much steeped in the, American Dietetic Association, like high carb, low fat kind of thing, and all the studies that have been done with that. And so I pulled that one up as an illustrative point. So. Yeah.
And then the only other thing is, when you hear Cordain talk, I think he always kind of has this sentence or phrase that he uses where he's like, I have a hard time believing, people when all I'm asking them to do is, why don't we increase the amount of fruit, veggies, and lean meats in your diet? Even though we're pretty paleoed out, like, I don't know how that, what are you going to eat instead of that that's any better? You know what I mean? Like.
He, in his book, did a comparison of American Dietetic Association recommended diet that included grains, dairy, and all that stuff, ran like 2,200 calories of it through a nutrition analyzer, and then did the same thing with a representative paleo diet. And the standard American diet, or not even standard American diet, it was like American Dietetic Association recommended deal, like low-fat, dairy, and all that sort of jive. You didn't even meet the recommended daily allowance on much of anything on that diet. Like, you were in deficit on most of your vitamins and minerals, whereas the paleo diet, it looked like you were taking a nutritional supplement, and the only things that you were deficient in were vitamin D and calcium, and then when we understand the role of acid-base balance and the fact that we got the bulk of our vitamin D from sunlight, then it all kind of made sense. It's like, oh, okay, this stuff fits together. And it actually makes sense logically on kind of first order principles, evolutionary biology, nutrition being a subset of biology. That all makes sense instead of it's just like some random studies that have no basis in reality. Yep. And Cordain's basic deal is like, hey, folks, let's try eating some more lean protein and then displace the grains, legumes, and dairy with more fruits and vegetables. Is that a reasonable supposition? And it makes people like the Chico State Nutrition, they're just like, burning their speculums and just going wild over this thing. They're just out of control over this. So it's really funny.
Insert a weekly Chico State Nutrition joke. Okay. All right, good question. Yeah, so folks, put comments up if you want a further fleshed out, list of counterarguments there. That was a solid 12 minutes of Rob Wolf knowledge. I think for today's show, that's enough, but we can certainly flesh that out if folks, really want to kind of spend some time looking at all those dimensions.
Yeah, and you could just give us some specifics that you want because, it could be a zillion different things. Acid-base balance, calcium, magnesium, bone mineral density, the kidney thing we touched on, like protein and cancer. Like, it could be a bunch of different stuff. So,
yeah. Yeah, that could be cool. All right, good. Next, we got a question from Ryan. Starts off with, can you talk a bit about cortisol and how to release or reduce or control with diet? So a little bit of background on Ryan, 6'4", 260, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, 2 to 3 times a week, CrossFit with extra strength work. Workouts are 4 to 5 on, 2 to 3 off. Mostly paleo, occasional cheat or binge. Was doing the anabolic diet, switched to paleo to give it a shot, as he's been stuck at 260 for about 6 months. He's been happy on paleo and doing well, but needs plenty of fruit to keep up with the jiu-jitsu, or at least he thinks he does. As for body, his arms, neck, face, and legs are decently lean. All the extra fat is in the belly. Don't really have love it handles, just belly fat. From one of your previous podcasts, you indicated this could be from excess cortisol. What should I do to get rid of the gut?
I'm guessing, like, the first thing I would throw in here, and this is something that Matt Lalonde and I have talked a bunch about, Annie and I have talked a bunch about, high training athlete, like Glenn Cordo is a good example, IFC lightweight champion, the way that we fed and watered him, protein and veggies and good fats for most meals, protein and like a yam or a sweet potato for post-workout meals. The yam or sweet potato is made up of starch. Starch is made up of glucose polymers. It's glucose strung together. And that glucose tends to replete or replenish muscle glycogen, preferential to fructose, which tends to replete liver glycogen. And if you get Matt Lalonde talking about fructose, you would think it is Satan incarnate. I mean, folks think that I'm over the top on this stuff. Like, Matt is like, it is poison. You shouldn't eat any of it. Like, he's even at the point where, like, blueberries and stuff are not really a worthwhile trade-off when you consider that you could eat, like, spinach and kale and stuff and get the same, like, lutein and, all that sort of jive. So the first thing that I would recommend for Ryan is that he would probably shift away from fruit for his carbs and more towards, like, a yam or sweet potato. And he keeps that stuff only in post-workout periods. He should then keep his feeding consistent. To go back to his question about how to mitigate cortisol, consistent feeding is really, really important. And that's one of the issues like Edo and Pulikan have about any type of fasting or intermittent fasting, is the potential for some sort of a cortisol exacerbation. Sleep is obviously a big deal with that. We've talked about this a bunch. The problem that we have seen with some people who are overtraining and or not sleeping enough and or incorporating intermittent fasting is that they start retaining fat right at the umbilicus, right at the belly button level. So that's kind of where you would be looking at for that cortisol stuff. So we would make sure that you eat consistently, that you sleep as long and as quality as you possibly can, control stress levels as best you can. Like for me, I've really had to mitigate my coffee intake, even though I've tried to commit suicide with espresso and have failed, but I think I've managed to really goof up my adrenals as a consequence of that. So that's the stuff I would tackle. I would tackle post-workout nutrition in a better way. I would ditch the fruit, go with more yam and sweet potatoes, stay consistent in your feedings throughout the rest of the day. And you should see some good benefit to that. We will probably at some point do some sort of like a short video segment on phosphatidylserine and how to figure out your dosage on that, because you can seriously goof yourself up with that stuff. So I'm not really going to get into details on that right now. Some AM, like a gram of buffered vitamin C can also help with cortisol. But I really think in this case, probably Ryan is just getting too many carbs and too much from fruit. I would shift more yam and sweet potato, and I bet it leans out immediately just from doing that.
Yeah, and I'm looking down at kind of the last two sentences. He says he gets 8 to 9 hours of sleep a night, except he does wake up a lot and then go back to sleep. Which sometimes, as we talked about, can be some of that funky cortisol stuff.
Right. And if he's doing jits, I know this has been a problem for me. I've really been wanting to get back into doing Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. It's almost always late at night. And late for me is, like heading towards like 5, 6, 7, 8. And frequently it's like 8 or 9 o'clock at night. That's when I used to do capoeira. It was always super late at night. And I always had early jobs. And so I would be super active relatively late in the evening, and then I was just awake and my sleep would be disturbed. I didn't get sound sleep. So if you can, like, getting a jits class that's a little bit earlier in the day would help. Like, that's a problem for me. Like, even doing CrossFit type stuff, if I'm doing any type of intense Metcon or heavy lifting, if it starts getting past like 5 o'clock in the evening, it definitely keeps me awake later. So that's some stuff to consider too.
Yeah, and I think the only other thing I would get on my soapbox about potentially, and maybe you can touch a little bit on, you know, how we've handled this with Glenn, I think there's some differences in volume, but, you know, Ryan's doing Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu 2 to 3 times a week. He's also doing CrossFit with extra strength work as much as I can. Like, I wonder what that CrossFit programming looks like. Like, I think when you're talking about, you know, potentially someone that's doing jits, it's pretty, you know, metabolically demanding. I get concerned about how much time we're spending outside of, you know, the training within CrossFit land, trying to build more metabolic capacity or really burning yourself out versus focusing more on some physical qualities that you may not be developing through some of your jits training.
Yeah, totally. Like with Glenn, if he's in off season, then we'll do a little bit more kind of classic CrossFit style stuff in addition to his strength work. But any time he starts getting near kind of fight camp, then the metabolic conditioning pretty much drops other than his fight conditioning. And so that's something to really keep an eye on. Ross Enemit's stuff is great on this because the dude is a beast. He's a phenomenal boxer. He's trained athletes from MMA to boxing to jits and all that. Like we have too, but I think it's nice to go outside to other communities and look at what they're doing. And Ross, in his books, the Never Gymless, and then the other one is Ultimate Intensity, Unlimited Intensity. I forget the name of it. It's a great book. But he makes the point again and again and again, if you're a fighter, then you really need to keep an eye on what you know, how much you're doing so that you can focus on the fighting. And the strength and conditioning needs to be supportive and adjunctive to that and not in place of that.
Yep.
There have been a ton of kind of big-name jiu-jitsu players who get in and start doing standard CrossFit stuff, and they get excited about it because it's another competitive environment and it's something fun, and there's always a bunch of hot chicks rolling around. And then their jits game starts tanking because they are crushed, and that you need to keep an eye on, you know, okay, what is my focus? If you're off season, then that's great. You can kind of shift gears a little bit. But unless you're a professional in this, you really, like Andy said, you need to keep an eye on where your focus is at. If he's rolling 3 days a week, I would think maybe one kind of circuit, almost fight gone bad-esque sort of thing a week, and then rotating that, and then maybe 2 days of like a upper body, lower body, 2 days where he's doing upper body and lower body both days of strength work, like a press and a squat one day, a deadlift and a weighted pull-up the other day, and that would be about it. I think that's going to be about as much as you're going to be able to stick into that program.
Yeah, I think only other thing goes back to, you know, tracking some benchmarks over time and kind of seeing what the variations in your volume of training does to some of those benchmarks.
Totally.
Yeah, because we could be beating yourself into the ground, or we have the folks on the, rut recovery giants, you know. That.
Yeah, and if you've got it, then definitely run with it. But few folks have that,
yep.
And they usually benefit from being smart and doing a little bit less, or at least less in punctuated doses, like every fourth week, a back off week, and stuff like that. So,
yep. Yeah. All right, good question. Next, we got a question from John. He wanted to thank us for the work we put into the podcast. Look at that, he loves it. See, that's positive feedback, Rob.
Is he listener number 5?
Well, judging by his numbers, he's not in the rest home community. So,
okay.
So he gave a little background. He's 5'5", 146, two years into CrossFit, 7-minute Helen, 14:40, filthy 50, you know, 8:25 CrossFit total. Did zone and zone paleo for 8 months and was kind of freaking out about everything having to be weighed and measured. Joined the club. He had to make sure all of his almonds were the same size and shit. You know, I want to share a little tidbit, and I'm not going to mention names, but there was a gentleman that I used to work out with in Arizona that was known to carry his almonds around in his pocket even to parties to make sure he would, get his 75 almonds a day. So you'd see him over in the corner of a party, like, having a beer or something, and then in between, you know, taking a handful out of his pocket, counting out his number of nuts, and secretly consuming them.
Yeah, but I've met this guy, and he's jacked, and his girlfriend is smoking hot, so... it may be where you need to go. I know exactly what you're talking about. So if you want to be jacked and have a smoking hot girlfriend, then you should walk around with your zone allotment of almonds and guaranteed.
I think he said stop that practice, and he's still jacked, and his girlfriend is still super hot. So.
Oh, okay, cool. All the better.
All right, so after he quit having his almonds the same size, he transitioned into a strict paleo diet. He has no dairy except the heavy cream in the coffee. He sleeps well 8 to 9 hours. He started IFing about 5 months ago and loves it. Very liberating not having to eat every 3 to 4 hours. Also, since started IFing, he's seen huge PRs in Metcon WODs and strength in OLIFs. Cool. So two questions. One, he needs coffee in the morning and always puts cream in it. Since he's fasting until around 3, is the cream breaking the fast and hurting the effects of it?
You know, I mean, technically it kind of is, but there's a reality that any type of modulation in our caloric intake, like if we eat, some good studies have shown that people simply eating less on a given day, say like they eat 40% less, they eat X amount of calories day one, they eat 40% fewer calories on day two, and they kind of cycle with that, they end up seeing a bunch of the benefits that we see with intermittent fasting. So it does kind of break the fast, but then at the same time, it's not a huge caloric intake, and it's all fat. So, I mean, to what degree that affects things, I have no idea. You know, and if he's still functioning well and he's seeing performance improvements, man, I wouldn't mess with it. That seems good to go. Talking with Martin Beckham, the lean gains guy, and emailing him a little bit, he really feels like about 16, 17 hours is about optimum on the intermittent fasting. And some reasons related to that's how long you've got a little bit of liver or hepatic glycogen storage. And usually that's how long you'll be able to avoid really digging into gluconeogenesis, breaking down muscle tissue to make glucose to keep your brain going. Even when we're very, very fat adapted and in ketosis, we still convert, or we still need some glucose to run like the brain and some of the red blood cells and all that. We still have some tissues that need some glucose. So for Martin, what he's trying to do is get like the minimum or maximum benefit, minimum cost, and he's around that 16 to 17 hour mark. So this is something that he might consider. He may be pushing the fast even a little bit too long, but obviously he's still making gains, but that's just something to keep in mind.
Yeah. Cream, that's good stuff.
I remember
those days. Anyway, next question. He takes whey protein in his post-workout shakes and just came across hemp hearts and was wondering if these would be a good sub for whey powder.
I would just stick with some sort of like Humboldt gold for the instead of the hemp hearts. It's a joke. I think the whey protein is fine post-workout. Like this dude is lean and jacked and has great numbers, so he's the perfect person for doing some post-workout dairy. I think that's fine, and I think for what he wants, which is really enhanced recovery and maybe even a little bit of a hormonal tweak with that insulin-like growth factor, growth hormone, all that stuff that the dairy definitely hits, the hemp hearts are not going to do that, so I would stick with the whey protein.
And then you want to take a quick look at his list of supplements there, Rob, to see if there's anything you think we should throw out while we're on the question.
He's doing vitamin D, some vitamin E, magnesium, zinc, glutamine, and creatine. That all seems fine. If he likes it, seems good to go. I don't see any problem with any of that.
Yep. Cool. All right. Good question. The hemp hearts thing, you know, it's funny. I think we were talking the other day how, like, questions come in cycles. Like, just recently, you know, Mark Sisson had a thing about, you know, similar thing. You know, this hemp protein's become really popular. What does he think of it? You know, is this primal? And it's just funny how, you know, you kind of get these little waves of the similar questions.
Right.
Hemp hearts are magic. They will turn me into Super Mario.
If that's the case, then I'm all about it.
Seriously, sign me up.
I would definitely give up one or two testicles to be Mario Putinowski. So, but I would actually probably need like 3 or 4 additional testicles to become Mario Putinowski.
Seriously,
that's the problem.
All right, next we got a question from Russell. He cited 2 kind of little case studies, which I won't read, but, you know, encourage the listeners to read kind of, you know, he finishes his quote of the case study saying, like, 2 small cases, but like you said, it's like this stuff almost works, which I think is what we find.
Right.
So moving on to the questions. Past 18 months, his diet has gradually evolved from zone, paleo zone with dairy to paleo. Recently, about 1.5 months ago, dropped dairy and soy and finally saw a noticeable difference in body comp. However, my workout intensity is currently mediocre at best and feel my diet is better than it has ever been. Generally trains around 1 p.m. This allows for a 6:30 a.m. breakfast, late morning snack, and then a 2:30 p.m. lunch. Dinner is usually at 7:30 and bed by 10. Couple of questions here. Workout intensity is mediocre and I'm exhausted when I get home, thus pretty unproductive before I head to bed. The only non-paleo item I'm eating is a builder bar after or before my workout sometimes if I can't get to real food. Any thoughts on why my intensity level is slacking?
I would be curious how he's handling the post-workout meal. Like, is he doing some carbs in there? I know, you know, Matt has kind of illustrated with his stuff that it's not a do-or-die thing to do carbohydrate post-workout for some people. I think for other people, it's really, really important, and that's something that folks need to tinker with and check out. Also, how many days a week is he training? Does he have any time off? Has he ever taken, like, a full week off within a, you know, like, go 3 weeks, take a back off week, go 12 to 15 weeks, take a full week off, like, not in the gym at all? If folks aren't doing that stuff, like they're never periodizing or tinkering their training volume, you're just going to get cooked at some point. It doesn't really matter what your nutrition is. Like, you're going to be zorched at the end of all that.
Yeah, I think this is a case, too, where, you know, it sounds like he's pretty busy. Sounds like his diet's pretty clean. Be curious also how much he's eating. And so for some folks, I find with men, sometimes they'll kind of get to the under-eating standpoint when they start going kind of strict paleo. Mm-hmm. So this is one where, you know, he could do a meal log just for 5 days and just kind of see where his caloric intake kind of fits overall. I'd be, you know, kind of curious what his total fat looks like. Because obviously in cases when you are possibly underfed, generally you're not going to feel real good and perform real well.
For sure. Like I've been tinkering with leaning out a little bit and just kind of cut back my fat intake, and my in-the-gym sessions have been miserable, absolutely miserable. And I definitely leaned out, but I didn't feel all that great, and it's kind of a trade-off back and forth on that. And so what I'm going to do is just kind of tackle that in a staggered approach where I do a couple of days a little bit more caloric restricted, a couple of days normal intake, kind of classic Fred Hatfield zigzag sort of thing. And I think that works pretty well. Your point about the lack of food is probably a big one. Because, man, if I'm just hammering calories, it is so much harder for me to overtrain, my perception of overtraining. Mm-hmm. It's as if I'm being kind of moderate in my fuel intake. For sure. That's a really good point.
Yeah, and I find it's more common with men. Now we have a couple dudes. Like, I know we met that guy this weekend that weighed 105 pounds or 85 pounds. He had no problems consuming like 5,000 and 6,000 calories a day. But most folks, I find, you know, don't end up on that side of the continuum naturally. Okay. All right, and then question two: there hasn't been much discussion on pre-WOD meals. We always talk about recovery eating, but what is the best thing to do pre-WOD? He's looking at this specifically because last year at the Rocky Mountain Qualifiers, he was top 15 in the first event, went home, ate some turkey, soup, potatoes, and nuts, and then proceeded to crash. He had a caffeine drink prior to the WOD, which is pretty typical. He could not wake up for the second WOD, even though he had about 3 hours to rest. I gave it less than a half-hearted attempt. It got destroyed. Immediately afterwards, someone handed me a builder bar, wolfed it down. Within 5 minutes, I felt like I could go back and do the workout again and do it better right then. So on non-multiple WOD days, what is the best pregame? And on comp days, what is the best in-between WOD food?
We touched on this a little bit at one time, and the pre-WOD deal depends on what type of WOD it is, because a filthy 50 is going to be a really different pre-meal need versus like a 5x5 back squat. So if you're doing strength work, I think like some protein only is probably a great way to go. If you're doing some sort of metabolic deal, then you need to figure out what your digestion is going to handle. One of my last CrossFit Journal pieces that they put up, like explorations in nutrition or something like that. I don't even know if that stuff is still up. It may have disappeared, but it basically looked at the CrossFit gamer, like a theoretical CrossFit gamer. And you really need to figure out like what you respond best to. Like, I've seen people who do great with a pre-game meal, like they'll do an orange and 2 ounces of turkey, and they just set the world on fire. They crush the workout. They have great digestion. They have no problems with that. With me, I would be barfing the stuff up. And so I need to be almost a little bit hungry going into kind of a metabolic session or doing a hard jits wrestling deal or something like that. So it's very, very, very subjective. Like, you have to play with that, and you have to figure out what your stomach responds well to. This is all stuff that you have to game plan ahead of time. And the post-workout meals, I see a lot more consistency. The pre-workout meals, it just seems way more variable. I see more variability than I do consistency. There's just these guidelines of, like, if it's strength work, you seem to do very well with protein pre-WOD. Although then, you know, Matt Lalonde and some other people have pointed out that we maybe get some better hormonal adaptations from a little bit of fasting pre-WOD. So that's even a very debatable point. You wonder if all the, you know, eat stuff is being skewed more by the bodybuilding scene than, you know, actual, like, legitimate need to pre-WOD fuel. But then when we start looking at something like metabolic conditioning, like the run deadlift example that he had, you just need to figure out what sits well with your stomach and gameplay some of this stuff.
I think
post-workout meals are critical. For the multi-event day, you're going to have to use some sort of a dense carbohydrate source, like a whey protein plus a maltodextrin, white grape juice might be an option because it's mainly glucose, got a little bit of fructose. On multiple event days, you do want a little bit of fructose in the mix because not only are you trying to replenish muscle glycogen, you also want to top off a little bit of hepatic glycogen, liver glycogen, because that is going to control your blood sugar levels from event to event, like from minute to minute.
Yeah, and I think this is we'll touch on this, you know, I think a little bit on the kind of game day eating stuff on a later question from Speed about some endurance stuff. But I think back to your comment about periodizing training, this is one where, you know, I'm generally, you know, I'm on the low end of, we'll call it, the recovery spectrum, not a fan of multiple day trainings. But I feel like if you're going to compete in some sport or event like the CrossFit Games, then you need to have periods in your program where you're playing with 2 and 3 or whatever, you know, day WOD, so you can, one, you know, get used to it. And I'm not talking about, you know, every day, but also experiment with your food intake to try to get the best feel for what's going to work for you when you go in there. You know, I think it's a mistake if you're only going to, if your whole year looks like, you know, 3 on, 1 off or something, and then you roll into, you know, the qualifiers and you're going to do 5 events in 2 days. Like, for most folks, I don't feel like they're going to perform their best unless they've played with what kind of food they can deal with, you know, kind of the ratios that they want to mess around with. If you look at, like, OPT's programming, right, there's periods where they're doing doubles, even triple days. There's periods where they're taking rest. There's, you know, periods of single day workouts. And I think you really have to experiment and periodize with that depending on kind of what goals you're going after and what kind of competitions you're going to enter.
Absolutely. I did some consulting with a girl who did really well with the East Coast qualifiers. And prior to, I forget the exact sequencing, but they did one event. She did really well with that, but she was pretty knackered afterwards. And I asked her how she had game planned all of her feeding beforehand, and she did nothing. You know, I mean, it just absolutely nothing. So folks will focus on their O-lifting and their gymnastics and their running and all that, and then the food is just like this completely, you know, not even a analyzed deal, and you really have to look at it in the context of your training volume, your training cycle, where in the day you're going to be competing. You know, like the 2008 CrossFit Games, we were operating with an assumption of about 3 hours between events. And then the 2009 CrossFit Games, like, there were people who were less than 45 minutes between events. So the ability to replete, to refuel after that was completely changed. And that's a tough one. And then I think this year, like, we're not, folks are not really going to know what the events are until, like, the day of or something like that. And so you need to really try to game plan as many different scenarios as you can. And if you are not playing with how you react to various types of feeding protocols and make sure that you don't get gas, you don't get indigestion and all that sort of stuff, and you need to be able to respond appropriately to all that.
Yeah. Good question. All right. Next, we got a question from Ken. He's been living what he believes is a paleo lifestyle and diet for the last year. In his readings and now life experience, there seems to be one huge issue that very smart people seem to believe very different things. He would love your current thinking on this issue. The issue is LDL particle size and LDL particle total number. When you eat and supplement this way, you will likely see your particle number very high or even increase. No doubt the proportion of small versus large particles will improve substantially, and that is definitely good. But how important is or dangerous is the high LDL particle number in your current thinking?
Cordain and some other folks just had kind of a global view of the cardiovascular disease risk, and they tackled this, and their perspective was that the LDL count was very minor in its effect in the total cardiovascular disease potential. Definitely, the size was much more of a factor. Small, dense LDL particles are usually generated from a high carbohydrate environment. And so when we see high triglycerides, we tend to see small, dense LDL particles, which are oxidizable. They tend to get stuck in the kind of nooks and crannies of the vascular bed. And this is where we can end up with atherosclerotic lesions and cardiovascular problems. So the trade-off here that we're trying to find, common wisdom from our docs and whatnot would say we need really low LDL counts so that we have fewer total particles floating around that can cause some sort of a problem. But what the somewhat counterpoint to this is that it's not so much how many of them are there, it's how many of them are small versus how many of them are large. Large, fluffy LDL particles tend to metabolize normally, tend to pass through the vascular lumen without problems. They pass in the liver without problems, and so they tend not to be a cardiovascular disease risk. What's his name again here? Ken. Ken shot us some numbers. The numbers that he shot, I'm not super familiar with how they report it, but what he shows is that initially the count goes from the total particle number goes from 1842, which it seems odd. Like, I'm not sure what units they're using to characterize that, and I'm not sure if in addition to the LDL particles are doing VLDLs and whatnot. So we're going to invite him to ship in, maybe like scan his full report so that we can get a really good look at that. But the small numbers that he has are 878, so they're comparatively high. And again, I'm used to seeing this stuff as kind of a histogram, like a graph that shows relative proportions of small versus large, and we're not getting that out of this. So I'm not sure if we can infer from this that out of 1842, that 878 of them are small dense, then we've probably got a relatively high situation there. And that's back in April of 2009. And at that time also, his triglycerides were 94. If we scroll down, and folks will have all this stuff on the podcast notes, we go down to December 2009, his total count is 2113, so it's up a little bit, but his small dense count is now 212. So as a fraction of the total LDL count, it's dropped precipitously, and then also his triglycerides are much lower. So my take on this is that his cardiovascular risk profile should have improved out of this. We could maybe bounce this. Is it Gray, Dr. Gray, the guy at HeartScan blog?
Oh, Dr. Davis?
Davis. So we can maybe ping this over to him, maybe bring him in on this and get his opinion on this. But my opinion on this would be that we've seen a really dramatic shift in the small, dense LDL particles down, and so there's much fewer of those, so we should have much less of a problem. We see a decrease in the triglycerides, so that's usually an indicator that systemic inflammation is less. But again, we're just going off of some numbers that are dropped in on this report, and so we don't see the total picture here.
Now, what's your experience, Rob, as far as what you see generally with total particle number for LDLs, kind of as folks shift to more paleolithic style of eating? So not necessarily worried about the size. Do you see, as far as just the general total number, do you see that remaining relatively consistent, going up, going down? Any thoughts on that?
It seems pretty variable. Some people, yep, it will actually drop. a bunch. Some people will go up a ton. Some people will budge up a little bit. Like, there seems to be quite a bit of variability on that. Michael Eads talked about this in Protein Power Life Plan, and that's why he makes the point that the LDL particle size is more important than the total count, because you can actually have a comparatively low count but a very, very atherogenic potential, because even though your total number of LDL particles is low, all of them, or very nearly all of them, are small, dense, and highly oxidizable. We just were working with a client who suffered a heart attack in his mid-40s. He had pretty high triglycerides, like around 160, 180 triglycerides, not super high, but relatively high. And then his HDLs were very, very low. His LDLs were not super high, but the particle size was horrible. And then he tweaked his food along paleo guidelines. His total count went up just a little bit, but the particle size, the small particles disappeared. The large particles became the predominant feature, and his whole cardiovascular risk profile has improved. The guy has a stent. He's been going to his normal cardiac rehab, telling his docs and cardiac rehab folks what he's doing. They're horrified, but they see him improving every week. And so they're curious now about what's going on, and I think he's a really good example that this stuff definitely works. And again, like, the global approach on this, in the show notes, we can put a link to this paper where Cordain and some other people, they basically say, yeah, LDL particles are a factor, but they're a very modest factor as compared to a bunch of other issues.
Cool. All right. Good stuff. Next, we have a question from, I'm not even going to try that name, Rob. You have a goal. You have an attempt at question number six name.
Haneke.
All right. That way, if you butchered it, it's not my fault. Anyway, he came across this article on this website, thebsdetective.com, which, believe it or not, I've never actually been there before, so that was interesting. And the gentleman that writes on thebsdetective.com thinks Gary Tobbs is a BSer, and he was wondering your thoughts on that.
Oh, man. This guy, what's his name? James Krieger?
Yeah, Krieger or Krieger.
Krieger. I kind of like his approach. Like, he's pretty thorough. He definitely takes himself very, very seriously, which is okay, I guess. But so he gets in and he takes Gary Tobbs to task on some stuff, you know, like the carbohydrate hypothesis that carbohydrates are the, you know, kind of the main cause of fat gain and whatnot. And so he ends up kind of dissecting this whole thing, and I kind of like how he tackles it, but the thing is this is just a very narrow view of this whole thing. Like the Ansel Keys study, where these guys are on a high carb caloric restricted diet, they're starving, they're real hungry, and then you look at some of the stuff that Michael Eads has talked about, in which people are on a very, very low, and Tobbs talks about this too. They're on a very low carbohydrate diet and similar levels of caloric restriction, and they're just not hungry at all. And I think that this is something, you know, Lyle McDonald and some other people that kind of decry the low-carb deal and the paleo deal and all that, they're like, it's all calories. Calories are all that matters, and, like, fat loss and all that. And it's obviously true up to a point, but then there's this reality that when people curtail their carbohydrate intake, they end up having a much better ability to control their total caloric intake. And this guy, Krieger, actually alludes to that later. He says, yeah, I like low-carbohydrate diets for the people who respond well to it. I find most people respond very favorably to it. The 10 or 15% that don't, like, you figure it out within about 3 weeks, and then you can find where they do better on a higher carbohydrate intake. So the analysis he does here is interesting, but it doesn't play to the fact that in free-living humans, we see again and again and again, when people focus primarily on food quality and on carbohydrate control, that they tend to be more successful on body composition and fat management than they do on any other type of protocol. Now, all these guys will argue that the end reason for that ultimately is because of caloric content, because protein is satiating and all that sort of jive, and that may all be true, but it still is the fact is that this basic approach of a low carbohydrate deal is going to ultimately work better. There was one other thought I had with this. He mentions in here, the Krieger, that insulin is anorexic, that insulin is satiating in some way. And I have just never, ever seen that anywhere. And my experience of this has been so contrary to that. And everything that we understand about, like, leptin metabolism, like, this is one of the problems with a low-carbohydrate diet or even, like, a cyclic low-carb diet with trying to make people big, put muscle mass on them. They're just not hungry. So when he threw this one out here, I haven't followed up on all this. It's a ton of material. But I that one just seemed like out on another planet. I've never heard of that one before. What's his other deal? Baseline insulin levels and future body gain. I'm not really going to hit that. So the fructose deal, it's kind of funny. He ends up talking about fructose, and it seemed like it was kind of new to him that fructose, although not, being high glycemic index, is actually high glycemic load and actually produces a whole lot of insulin and insulin resistance. That seems to be kind of new to him. So I'm not too sure where to tackle that. I don't know. I mean, overall, I kind of like the guy's approach. It's very systematic, but I just think he's taken a really narrow view of this whole thing, calls Gary Cobbs a bullshitter, and then at the end of the whole thing, he says, but I generally like low-carb diets for the people that they work in. And I guess he's just trying to get in and argue some nuances about what the mechanisms are, which I guess that's cool, but I just don't see these things quantitatively really adding all that much to the conversation in this deal. And then we, the leptin thing, this one, maybe we could come back and look at it in depth, but it's just so much material to carve through. But I don't know, folks, if folks look at this and they look at what he has to say and what I've commented on this and you want to see a deeper analysis of this, we can definitely get into it. I'm just trying not to make it a one-hour show just on this one question.
Yeah, and this was one where his analysis, I felt, was apropos, though, for its length, considering, how long good calories, bad calories is.
Yeah, I mean, that's like a 700-page book, so it's, yeah.
But, yeah. Anyway, next we had a question from Tom. He says, you tend to speak highly about the use of coconut as a fat source, but it seems like coconut is a rather exotic food from an evolutionary standpoint. It probably was not widely consumed until Neolithic times, and even then was probably available only to a small group of humans. Just because we haven't eaten it for hundreds of thousands of years does not mean it is bad for us, but I was wondering if you have thoughts on the matter.
Shoot, it's a good question. I think Cordain and Pedro Bastos just did a post on coconut, and I haven't even been able to read it yet. Somebody actually just alerted me to it, but talking about how it's not insulin, doesn't produce insulin resistance and some other issues. It's interesting from the evolutionary standpoint. Olive oil we never used in an evolutionary context.
Yep.
It's a high monounsaturated fat. It appears healthy, although you'll get some people who will argue that point and say that even the fact that it's monounsaturated is bad because it still has a higher oxidizable potential to it and everything. Not everything that we ate, if you were to say purely ancestral diet, we'd probably have to look at, kind of sub-Saharan Africa as being the primary driver. And then as we expanded out from that area, you had foods that we were, either more or less similar or dissimilar to that ancestral environment. And then we had potential for maladaptation to these novel foods. And we see that a lot with the foods that were in the Americas, all the tomatoes, potatoes, eggplants, all the nightshade type stuff. Some people seem to do okay on that stuff. Some people, they seem to be really problematic. They definitely have gut irritating potential. So it's gee whiz. I mean, I'm not even too sure how to tackle this thing. It's a really good question, but the fundamental thing is folks seem to eat coconut. They seem to do well on it. Trying to couch it in some sort of an evolutionary context, if you buy into the aquatic ape scenario, then maybe we were eating coconut fairly early on. Other than that, short chain saturated fats have been a part of the ancestral diet for the whole run because these are a part of grass-fed meats and even grain-fed meats, they just tend to play a lower role in those meats. Whereas coconut is almost 100%. These MCTs, these medium-chain triglycerides, the 12, 14 carbon saturated fats.
Yeah, I think this is a great question, but it's one that I'm not sure there's an easy answer to. I mean, there's a ton of stuff, like I say, olive oil, this wonderful caffeine that I'm drinking today that obviously in certain parts of the world wasn't consumed in Paleolithic times that, you know, we still enjoy. So I always go back to that, your comment about, you know, we're taking this viewpoint, this framework, this technology of the Paleolithic or ancestral diet, and then kind of applying that to modern times.
Yeah, because there's really good studies that indicate that coffee consumption is, you know, kind of a dose response. The more coffee you drink, the better your insulin sensitivity, the longer you live. And obviously, then also we've talked about like adrenal fatigue and how that can be overdone. But there's some sort of good stuff that comes out of drinking coffee, for example. And obviously, coffee was not part of the ancestral environment, but it tastes good and it makes you feel good. And like, you know, Chico, the sun hasn't been out in like 2 weeks. I'm ready to blow my brains out. And it's probably the difference between me going on and doing like some sort of a Kurt Cobain gig. And so this is where like I try emphatically, you know, I'm so excited about people pushing and talking about the whole paleo concept, but at the same time, don't want it to turn into religion, don't want it to turn into this thing where people are like, oh, we did, you know, it you can't throw the baby out with the bathwater. Like, there's a bunch of stuff that just is evolutionarily novel, but it still is good for you. And then there's stuff that's it's old as dirt, it's been around a long time, and it's not all that great for you, and grains are a perfect example of that. And I think that's where we've got some theory, and then we need to mitigate or, you know, modulate that theory with, like, what's our basic experience of this stuff? Like, what does it actually produce result-wise?
Yep. All right. Good question, though. All right, next we got a question from Speed. I think his first name is Ryan, and I don't know if his name is, legitimately Speed, but if that is, and he says he's an ultra endurance runner, like, that's a badass name for a runner.
That is very cool.
I used to swim against a girl way back in the day who was like a legit, you know, super high performing butterfly, you know, sprinter, and her last name was Hammer, and it was just perfect for her event, you know. And I'm like, dude, if your name is actually Speed and you're an ultra endurance runner, the gods were smiling on you when you were named.
They call that a nominative determinism.
That's right. That's right.
You're Jared Fisher and you actually go out and catch fish and stuff like that.
That's awesome. All right, so question from Speed. I think this goes back to kind of prepping for game day, depending on what game day that is. So what type of suggestions do you have for an endurance athlete's paleo nutrition needs during an ultra event, anything beyond 22.6 miles, specifically 50 to 100-mile foot races? He adopted CrossFit endurance training as of March 09 and love it. Along with the change in training came a change in fuel intake, switching from normal high carb to a zone, and then a 90% paleo zone. The how do you look, feel, and perform markers were always high during training. Problem arose during actual race events. After 2 hours during two different marathons, my energy would just plummet. I know part of the reason was not enough calories. I was scared to take in any of the normal race grub, gels, M&Ms, PB&J sandwiches due to possible gastric distress. Obviously a bad idea when you're 20 miles into a race. He spent a lot of time on the CrossFit Endurance Forum asking questions and plans on attending a cert that will have BMAC or Borg presenting this spring, but his first scheduled race is before that cert. Any help on the subject is greatly appreciated.
You know, this is that thing again where like training nutrition versus game day nutrition are just two completely different animals. And again, to some degree, you need to gameplay this stuff. I am by no means an endurance athlete, nor an endurance coach, but we've seen people do really, really well. And I think BMAC and Carl and the endurance dudes, even some of the stuff that I've seen Mark Twight comment on this stuff, general day-to-day training, it's a high-fat, paleo-esque sort of diet. And then when game day rolls around, you're going to need more carbs, period. How you get that stuff, I think, can really determine levels of success and whatnot. The deal that I have with gels and goo and stuff like that, it tends to be very hygroscopic. It draws water into it. So you can get some serious gastric upset from that. It also tends to be very, very kind of acid forming. People forget that when we're lactate producing machines, we're inducing a net acid load on our body, and that needs to be buffered, and that can be an issue. That's where stuff like Cytomax, and I think there's a Cytomax now that has some whey protein in it. That stuff is legit. That is really, really good. I got roped into doing an 80-mile mountain bike ride in Montana, and this was back when all I was doing really was powerlifting and a little bit of kickboxing. Like, I didn't have anywhere near the kind of metabolic conditioning that I have now, and I used that Cytomax, and I just had a constant titration of this stuff going, and I just stayed under my red line. Like, when my legs started spicing up a little bit from the lactate production, I would just dial back my RPMs on the pedals. And I kept up with these guys who were, all that they did really was mountain bike. So I had a pretty good size engine, and then I fueled really smartly, and I kept up with them fine. The issue that you're going to face on longer events is that you're going to need everything, carbohydrate, protein, and a little bit of fat. But usually the amount of fat is less. You're going to need some protein, because as you get deeper and deeper into the race, your body is going to be so hungry for carbohydrate, it will start metabolizing branched-chain amino acids and converting those into glucose, gluconeogenesis. All that you're left then with is stuff like, not tyrosine, tryptophan. Tryptophan is the serotonin precursor. So folks that are in very, very long races will actually start getting lethargic and fall asleep. Like, they'll be jogging along and then literally just kind of like auger into the ditch and fall asleep because they had so much tryptophan going through the blood-brain barrier because they had underfueled on protein. So you need some sort of a protein-carb combo. I know, like, Brian McKenzie ends up eating stuff like pizzas and cheesecakes when he's out on these 100-mile races. Like, he orders the stuff ahead and, like, prepays with his credit card, and, the dude is literally waiting at like Checkpoint Charlie. Oh man, I should have turned off Ring Central. Crap, sorry folks. Okay, that thing's off. So, like, this pizza will be waiting for him and he'll eat that, but he does okay with it. Like this guy mentioned, how your stomach is going to deal with a pizza or a cheesecake come game day, I don't know. And that's where I would be more inclined to stick with, like, a Cytomax or something like that that has, like, a lactate buffer. Some sort of a buffered lactate solution, plus protein, plus some sort of maltodextrin, and maybe just a little smidge of fructose in it for, again, filling up that liver glycogen. You're going to have to address that also.
Yeah, I swear at some point there on the CrossFit Journal video, there's a video, at least a part of BMAC talking about this, because I remember him talking about the burgers and the pizza that he would, periodically keep in his diet because he would need to be able to consume that stuff during race day. But I think, and as you said, we are by no means the endurance experts. We're, like, far afield from that.
Yeah.
But I think if you look, like, Dean Karnazzi, like the marathon man guy that ran, like, a zillion marathons in consecutive days, if I recall correctly from reading that book, maybe I'll dig it up, but he had something similar where I would consider his diets pretty paleo. And then same thing, though, to fuel his performance during the races, he would do that similar kind of thing. We'd have pizza, he'd have cheesecake, one, to get enough of calories, and, also to get some of that kind of starchy carbs in there. But I think, kind of like you see with some of our military folks that will eventually, be possibly deployed in Iraq and eat the MREs, which, will cause some gastric distress, they may have to keep, a small amount of some of these foods in their diet throughout the year to help, their stomach be prepared for game day.
Yeah, and again, you just have to play with this stuff and test it out and see how you do. I think from a no gas, no problem with the gastric emptying and all that, I think stuff like Cytomax with protein is a pretty good option. I also think people get sick of things like that, and so that's where, like, some solid food actually becomes kind of nice, something a little tastier. But you're just going to have to play with it. But I wouldn't shy away on game day from stuff that normally you wouldn't eat, pizza, cheesecake, whatever. It would destroy me. I wouldn't be able to go with an option like that. But you can always construct something that is protein, carbs, and fat from some sort of a kind of paleo sort of source. We've done pemmican before, where you do like coconut oil, grind up a bunch of nuts, put coconut oil on top of that, and it solidifies, and then you have some dried fruit mixed into that, and that's delicious and super caloric dense. But again, you need to make sure that it's the right air-fuel ratio. A big factor that you need to consider, usually in the 100-mile foot races, although they're horrible and they're grinding and all that, people are not setting blistering paces on these things. So you're generally kind of staying below your lactate threshold. You may have periods of time in which you go above that, but if your event is of low enough intensity, then gastric emptying may not be an issue. But if it's of high enough intensity, or you eat a big enough meal, or the meal has enough fat in it, then gastric emptying is going to become an issue, and you shunt blood away from the muscles into the stomach. And then you're going to end up with cramps, you're going to end up with, or if you're performing so at such a high level, you actually shunt a lot of blood away from your abdominal viscera, and you can't digest food. So, I mean, it's just a lot of shit that you need to keep your eyes on, and you need to practice it. There's no solid recipe that I can give that hits everybody. There's some basic guidelines, and then you have to gameplay this stuff.
Favorite part of this question, Rob, is he's like, after 2 hours during two different marathons, I'm like, 2 hours into your run, I probably would die.
Yeah, 2 hours into a drive, I'm usually fatigued. So, yeah.
All right. Good question. I think that was a good one. A little different than the standard. We don't get a lot of endurance questions, Rob. I think that's because people know you don't like to do anything longer than like 5 minutes.
We have scared them almost as much as the vegetarians. So, yeah.
All right. Next, we got a question from Kyle. His wife and I have been batting around exploring the idea of going paleo for a couple of months now. As he writes this on January 4th, he's officially halfway into day one. All right. His question is geared more towards his wife's potential experience than his own. She is a rather competitive runner and rather well muscled for being as lean as she is, meaning she could handle a few more pounds of body fat. We recently discovered that she is pregnant! Exclamation point. Congratulations to you and your wife, Kyle. That's awesome. We are thrilled with the news, but a little curious as to what the implications might be for her going forward with moving towards paleo. Is there anything that she needs to be aware of?
She'll be healthier, and the kid will do better, and she'll probably perform better. It's really funny how with the pregnancy deal seems to like medicalize all of a sudden the mom and the baby are like this medical experiment, and like everything else is out the window. You know, it's like the food needs to change. They can't exercise. Like, just everything becomes an issue, and I know that people take it seriously, and that's good, and that's really important. But I mean, the fundamental thing is if it's a healthy way to eat, or let's say a healthier way to eat, and I think you could argue that from a zillion different levels, from like autoimmune exposure, allergy potential, simply how much nutrients you're getting in, and we end up seeing that there's no way that you can't slice or dice it in some sort of a paleo-esque approach isn't more nutritious. Now, a lot of women will end up having some problems with protein during the early stages of pregnancy. They just don't want to see, smell, experience meat. And I think in that situation, then you just play to whatever it is that they like. And again, you know, I'm obviously like the anti-gluten nut. I try to push people towards staying as paleo as they can. I think it's better for mom. I think it's better for the baby. If you're going to opt for some sort of like crackers or something, go for like a rice cracker or something like that over like a saltine. I think those are minor modifications that I see benefit people again and again and again. And that would be kind of the only stuff I would really push. And then obviously keep the mom taking fish oil. And she should be good to go.
Yeah. Good question. Hopefully, Kyle, you're still well into your paleo lifestyle. I'm not sure a half day really counts.
I think it's hilarious that he documented the half day point. So obviously, Kyle is counting down the minutes. So, yeah, good to go.
Drink some coconut milk. It'll make you feel better. Next, we got a question from, I'm going to say this, Niall. Based on I have a friend with a similar spelled name, so hopefully I didn't butcher that. He was curious as to your thoughts on metabolic typing. I've recently read the book, and it seems like a pretty logical idea. What are your thoughts, and have you ever tried it?
I've read it. It just doesn't make any sense to me at all. It just seems like voodoo. And when we've really poked around on it, when you get into the metabolic typing, they end up recommending like grains and dairy and all this stuff for virtually everybody. There was a book that Ito recommended to me on kind of like optimizing neurological function or something, and I was really fired up about it. And I got in and read the book, and I was like, it sounds intriguing. And then they got into the food, and like they had breakfasts that were predicated on like a piece of dry toast and a three-egg omelet, and egg white omelet and stuff. And I'm like, oh, man, this is killing me. And it largely is built around the metabolic typing stuff. I wish there was something to it. I just personally don't see anything to it at all. Like the fast oxidizer, slow oxidizer, there's been a bunch of different stuff out there. I just don't see anything beating getting in and doing something that is pretty akin to like a lowish carb paleo approach, and then playing with your carbohydrate fueling based on what your work output is. I just don't see much of anything beating that. It just it's not very scientific, it's not very jiggy in that you can't create a bunch of like subgenres of like metabolic typing off of it. So I wish there was something to it. This is a little bit like the blood type diet. Like the Dr. Eads, when the blood type deal came out, he was really excited about it, and they started playing with it in their practice. And even though it was recommending like a kind of high-carb vegetarian deal for A blood types, he's like, well, we'll look at it and try. And it was about as impactful as astrology was on his practice. So that's what I got for it. Play with it and see, but I haven't seen anything worthwhile in it at all.
Yeah, I don't think we've seen with any of those various magic technologies, super good results on any of those. Although it'd be cool if they worked better than what we already do.
Yeah, that would be great. I mean, that would be spectacular. I would love that. I just haven't seen it. And also, I did a very, very extensive written blog post on metabolic typing. So again, like if folks are thinking about a particular topic, by all means, throw it into us, but also pop it up in the search function, because there's a pretty good chance that I've hit it. So,
yeah. All right. Good question. Next, we got a question from John. Enjoy your blog. Trying to come to grips with the difference between the Paleo Zone diet and the Paleo Zone athlete model. So I think he means the Paleo diet versus the Paleo athlete model. Can you, in a nutshell, let me know the difference? He owned the book once, but gave it to a friend.
Well, so the way that I break this stuff down in my mind, if somebody says zone, then they're talking about a specific weighed and measured macronutrient approach, protein, carbohydrate, and fat. They don't make any distinction about food quality. If we hear paleo zone, then we're taking the best quality foods that we can get and slicing and dicing them, excuse me, into some sort of, 40-30-30-esque ratios is usually where that starts. Then when we start talking paleo zone, athlete's zone within that context, then we're talking about an increase in fat to make that whole situation long-term sustainable, because the zone, as is generally written in Enter the Zone and in like the CrossFit Journal 21 on how to tackle the zone, that all starts off as a calorie-restricted approach, and it's not sustainable long-term. And so you have to increase the fat content to make it long-term sustainable. And then people ask questions about why you don't increase the total blocks, and I think we've tackled that elsewhere, but that's kind of the distinction. So zone is a macronutrient approach, doesn't distinguish about food quality. Paleo zone, we have a food quality orientation, but with an eye towards some specific macronutrients. Athlete's model is where we increase the amount of fat to make the thing long-term sustainable. All that stuff said, I think for the vast majority of people, we usually find that the basic zone protocol is too many carbs for most people. Russ Green commented on my blog a while back, pointing out that there are some people out there that do better on higher amounts of carbs even than the zone. And that's absolutely true. That's something that we need to keep in mind, but I will still kind of default back that the vast majority of people end up benefiting, from what I've seen, from a sub-zone level of dietary carbs.
So, Rob, now I'm going to ask the question that I think John was asking. It's hilarious. We both read that question, and I think we interpreted it differently. So what I think John is asking is what the difference between the paleo diet book is and the paleo diet for athletes book model. Because I don't recall in either of those books the zone word. So I'm not sure what. And then, so anyway, why don't you throw out the differences between those two as well, and then we've hit it from all angles, and I don't know if you're right or I'm right, but hopefully we'll have answered John's question.
Well, I definitely didn't get that, but I mean, paleo diet for athletes is basically unweighed, unmeasured kind of paleo diet. They break it into an in-season and an off-season protocol. The off-season protocol tends to be higher protein and lower carb. Although it's not really low carb by what I would say, but it's lower. And then the in-season protocol ends up ramping up the carbohydrate. You start taking more advantage of some stuff like maltodextrin for post-workout, glycogen repletion and all that, restoring muscle glycogen. And that's kind of the big difference. That's what the paleo diet for athletes is.
Yeah. So hopefully, John, somewhere in that we got the question right and got you the answer.
It was even a different question. We failed on all counts, but that would be consistent with us.
Yeah. Rob, will you have some faith in our ability to read questions?
I will try, but I am consistent in my application that we'll probably botch it. So.
Well, John, if we didn't answer your question, let us know. We'll take another pass. All right, well, I think that's it, Rob. We're at 115. I feel like we're bleeding upwards every week, so I'm going to have to, our standard number of questions, we might have to dial them back because we're talking too long. We're having too much fun.
And I'm really trying not to deviate off to the side too much, but that tends to happen also. So, yeah, we'll try to stay on task. Apologies for running over.
Yeah, and we'll work on also getting those short video clips in the queue so that we can start putting those up as well.
Yeah, the two that I really want to tackle immediately are a protocol for using digestive enzymes that contain betaine hydrochloride, because I think that's a huge factor for a lot of folks. And then the other one is hopefully a simple protocol for dealing with cortisol management and using some phosphatidylserine and that whole thing, because that stuff is very powerful and can definitely goof you up.
Yep. Perfect. Well, I think, Rob, with that, we are done with episode 11. And go back to working on your book.
Okay, will do.
All right, man. I'll talk to you next week. Thank you.
Thanks, Andy.
All right, see you, Rob.